So last week we did our Salvatic on the Haggadah, and you'll see a very drastic shift tonight. So our Salvatic, as we saw, was very analytical, very precise, and really focused on a lot of the details and the nitty gritty, and then tried to analyze it and come up with categories of thought. But we got a feel last week for Salvatic. Rav Kook is different, and we're almost kind of transitioning from Rav Salvatic to Rav Kook to Hasidic thought. So Hasidic thought is, you know, almost entirely it's almost entirely homiletical. Okay, its nature is to be homiletical. Right, the nature of Hasidic thought is to not take things too literally. The nature of, you know, the brisker thought, the Salvatic thought, is that they take things very literally, right? To take them so literally that you will look into any different emphasis, you know, any word deviation, anything like that. Rav Kook is more thematic, okay? He will get his themes from concepts, and he'll get his themes from descriptions in the Torah or how certain things are written, but ultimately his goal is thematic, okay? Rav Kook was a big picture thinker, and he always wanted to kind of bring out the big picture thought. Now, Rav Kook has some major themes that he'll talk about, and he always, you know, when you talk about rabbis at certain points in history, you always have to keep in mind when they were living, who they were talking to, and kind of what their purpose was. So, you know, the Rambam writes certain ways he does, or writes certain books because of the times he's in, and because of the people, because of his audience. And that's true of, you know, any author. And Rav Kook is no different. You know, when Rav Kook decides, and as we talked about, who was here for Rav Kook's history, his biography, who was here for that? Okay. So, when Rav Kook decides to move to Israel, okay, and then stay in Israel and become the first chief rabbi of Palestine. He died in 1935, so there was no he was not the first chief rabbi of Israel because there was no state of Israel. Obviously, that is his focus. And as we talked about in the history class, Rav Kook's focus is on a return to the land of Israel. But it's more than just that, right? His focus is not just, you know, hey, Israel's important, let's love Israel, let's all go to Israel. It's more than just that. He's trying to reframe the way the Jewish people look at themselves, okay? And after thousands of years of distinction, of separation, of exile, you know, the truth was, Jews in different cultures did not interact with each other very much. And when they did, it didn't necessarily go very well, right? And look, German Jews and Lithuanian Jews looked at each other as very polar opposites. That began to change in the 20th century. But if you're a Jew living in Lithuania, how many Sephardic Jews are you meeting in your lifetime? Zero, exactly. Zero. Lito, yes.
What I want to know, is the Torah was the same to one as the other?
The Torah is the same for everyone.
Okay.
But over hundreds and hundreds of years of living separately, living in different cultures, different customs develop, different focuses develop. But it's more cultural than anything, right? It's more cultural than anything.
Okay.
The fact is, if you take your American Jew, right, even if he's a pretty religious American Jew, and you put him in a room with a secular non-Jewish American versus a Sephardi Israeli who doesn't speak any English, who are they gonna enjoy spending time with? Who are they gonna more to talk about? Right? They're gonna connect better just culturally with the American secular person, right? Because they can relate to each other better for the most part. There could be exceptions, but typically, you know, now one of the things that makes the Jewish people unique is a certain connection to people who are Jewish all around the world, even without that same cultural connection. But in many ways, it's the state of Israel that's really began to bring together all these different elements of the Jewish community and to make them into one unit. But for the most part, the Jewish communities were very, very segregated. And like I said, you know, when Jews came to America, right? How did they congregate here in America? They congregated based on their country of origin, right? That was the German community. That was the Hungarian community. That was the Polish community. And that's not just it's language, it's culture, it's a lot of different things. But we were forced in many ways to begin to come together. And what we have now in the state of Israel, right, to now have a country where in one city you can have Jews from German descent, Lithuanian descent, Persian descent, Iraq, Morocco, all in one city, it is a phenomenon we haven't seen in 1500 years. So, and the longer we were segregated, the more separate we were. So what Rav Kook was trying to do was, number one, Rav Kook wasn't only trying to impress upon people the importance of Israel and moving to Israel. He was impressing upon people the importance of recognizing that the Jewish people are a unit, or a whole. And it's a very easy thing to say. It's a very hard thing to really wrap your head around. It's a very hard thing to really take seriously, right? And there's accountability for Jews around the world. The sense that, as hard as it seems that we would ever come together and form a people again, it is possible. It is possible. Look, just look in Tanakh, right? Look in the stories and the prophets of the different tribes trying to get along. Right? I mean, sometimes it worked, but very often it didn't. And you had times when certain tribes were basically isolated from the other tribes. And there were civil wars. I mean, there were civil wars within tribes because of different cultures, because of something one tribe was doing. And so, this isn't new, but it becomes definitely more obvious when we've been separated by oceans and separated by cultures. Okay, so just that as a caveat. So that's what I'm saying. When Rav Kook talks about the Haggadah, his focus is thematic, but he that's the way he thought. He thought big picture. Yeah.
I believe it was Rabbi Kook who said, "There's much more that unites us than it divides us."
I don't know if that's his original idea. I don't know.
I think that was...
It could be. No, and Rav Kook was also... I don't want to repeat the whole history class, but Rav Kook was very adamant in recognizing the importance of the secular Jews who made Aliyah, and embracing them and working with them and not judging them, and realizing their important role and seeing the goodness in what they were doing and the sincerity in what they were doing and rebuilding the land of Israel, even if it was not from a religious context, something that even till today many religious groups have a hard time really seeing. Right? Very hard time. And Rav Kook was able to see it. Was able to really embrace that. So, okay, let's get into... I've got four different pieces by him, none of them long, and concepts that we're familiar with already. And we'll see if we get through all four. If not, at least to get a taste of it. Okay. The first one's about the four sons. Okay, the wise son. Good evening. So this is what it says in the wise son. Do we have a Haggadah here? Probably not. All right, I'll just paraphrase it.
Yeah.
Oh, is there? Oh, perfect.
No, the right one is better.
This is also one. I guess someone was learning it. Okay. The four children. Perfect. Chachamahu Omer. Ma edut ve'achukim ve'amishpatim asher tziva Hashem Elokecha Elokeinu etchem ve'afata emer lo ki hilchos ha-pesach e'em aftirin achar pesach afikomen. The wise child, what does he say? He asks, what are the symbols, rules, and laws that God, our Lord, has commanded you? Then you shall tell him all the laws of Passover up to we do not taste anything after the Passover afikomen. Okay, so a few questions that he asks on this. The first question is this. The wise son does not seem to be very wise. Right? He doesn't know anything. Right? He's the wise son asks, what are the symbols, rules, and laws that God our Lord has commanded you? He doesn't seem to know anything. He's asking, what is all this stuff? Okay? So, how does this make him wise?
He's asking a question.
But I mean, they all ask... Yeah, I mean, the rush asked the question. Yeah, that's true.
You're saying he's smart enough to ask what he doesn't know.
He wants to know all of
it. He's asking right questions.
Okay, so...
What's the question? What does he say?
This is how the wise son begins. The wise child, what does he say? He asks, what are the symbols, rules, and laws that God, our Lord, has commanded you?
Why does he say you instead of us?
So that's part of it. And that's what we harp on the evil son.
Yeah.
We harp on him because he says, wait a second, it's you. The language is a little different. Etchem and lachem are a little bit different. So in the Hebrew, there is a distinction. And it seems a little bit less accusatory, but it's still a good question. That's not his focus, but it's a good question. So that's number one. And the answer is, we tell him all the laws of Passover. Up to, we do not taste anything after the Passover afikomen. So that's where we end the story. So then he says, why get into the specific? Just say, teach him about the laws of Passover. Why say and end with the afikomen? So this is his idea. Okay. What does the wise son notice that the other children don't seem to notice?
That it's different tonight. He's noticing that there's difference.
Different in what way?
The four questions.
Okay, well, he doesn't reference the four questions per se.
But he noticed that there's something going on here that isn't normal.
The customs.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's picking up on the details, right? Right. What are the symbols, rules, and laws? That's already three distinctions. Eidut, Chukim, and Mishpatim. He's picking up on all the little intricacies that are happening. Okay? The other children don't. When the Rush asks his question, what is the evil son's question? What does he say? He asks, what is this service to you? What is this? Right? And the simple child says, what is this? Right? Mazdot. They don't see the details. They just see they have a sense of something. But they're not picking up on the nuances. Right? And so what makes the wise son unique, again, they're all asking questions, but he's asking questions that come from a real, true observation, right? And it's funny. What exactly was the story? We've had, people at our house before, who've never done Shabbat before, okay? And so they've never done a traditional Shabbat meal. And what we've learned is that you better be very careful what you do, because they will watch you and think things are part of the meal when they have nothing to do with anything, right? So one time, I got up after I washed my hands before hamotzi, and I went and I got a book and I moved it towards the table because I was gonna use it later or something. And then they ask, so is that the custom that after you wash your hands you get a book? Like those kinds of things. Because, they're trying to pick it up. They're trying to understand it. And they don't have the context to know what is ritual and what is, idiosyncrasy or just, happenstance.
It's like putting a towel over your shoulder. They think it's
no, exactly. The way to right. do it. Right, right. But the truth is, if it's all new to you, you can't make that distinction. You have no idea, right? Yeah, I don't know what's going on here.
To put a towel over your shoulder.
No, exactly. It's like, if I watch a baseball game with one of my kids, so I'm watching the game, but they're picking up all the side things, right? How come that guy's always scratching his nose? What's that guy over there doing? The third base coach. Why does he just stand there? What happens if the ball hits him and he catches it? Is the guy? Yeah, all these questions, I don't know. I never thought. I don't know. Let's focus on the important stuff. But it's only important if you have a sense of context and you can say this is important and this is not. So the important step for wisdom of the wise child is that he's picking this up. He's asking questions. And he's asking the right question, but what's right about the question is that there's a detail to it. He's asking because he's observing. Okay? And why is that important? And why is that important? So he says it's important because, you know, the nature of Torah, the nature of Judaism, is a very, there's a detail element to Judaism. Right? There's a detail element to Judaism. And to really appreciate something, to really enjoy something, it's hard to really do it without detail. Okay? It's hard to do without detail. And the more you understand something, and the more you delve into it, and the more details you understand of something, the more you can appreciate it. Right? So if you go to the symphony, and you don't really know much about composers, and you don't really know much about classical music, you'll kind of enjoy it on some level. Right? I kind of get it. It seems nice. It's pleasant. Right? But if you really understand it, and I'm not one of those people, but there are people that do, right? And these people go to symphonies, and they're very serious about it. And I, you know, symphonies are serious places. They're appreciating it at a whole different level, right? They're appreciating it at a whole different level. And the world as a whole, if you don't know about things, you can't appreciate them. Things will just pass right over you, right? If you don't know the history of civil rights in America, then you won't understand the reaction of many people to President Obama being elected. They'll just wash right over you, right? You won't get it because you don't have the context for it. And that comes with culture, and that comes with knowledge, and that comes with understanding. But the more you understand of something, the more you can appreciate it and enjoy it and get something out of it, okay? So the idea is that Judaism is the same way. Is we're not detail-focused because we're neurotic, although we are, right? That's for other reasons, right? Right? We're detail-focused because if you want to appreciate something and you want to enjoy something and you want to have a deeper sense of understanding of something, you have to ask a lot of questions and you have to delve into it, and there has to be details to it. So, you know, and you know, people who don't like the fact that Judaism is so detail-oriented and all these laws and who needs all these laws, right, in other aspects of their life are quite comfortable with that concept, right? Or, you know, I mean, you know, you watch football and, you know, every rule and every permeation, every rule, and oh my God. Now that's, it's only false start if they move this way but not that way, but the defense, you know, like, we're fine with that. And we're fine with making ourselves crazy with nuances of rules and laws and things that we enjoy, right? Because then we appreciate it more. And if people don't look at it that way, right, we get snobby and condescending about it, right? You don't really understand what's going on here, right? I really understand. You could watch it. I'll let you watch it if you don't really get it, right? So there's a certain condescending, right? But when it comes to Judaism, we get annoyed, right? Oh, it's too detailed, all these details. You're neurotic about it. So, but the fact is, when you really want to understand and appreciate something, then that's what comes out of it. So the point he's making is that that is the essence of the wise son. The essence of the wise son is he understands the concept that to really appreciate something, you have to know the details. And the questions of the other children, you know, they're not picking up on the details, but they're missing that basic understanding of what it means to appreciate something. So they're never really going to get out of the Seder, because the Seder is all details, right? We're doing this, then we're doing that, we got our order, we got our stuff, right? That's the whole essence of the Seder. If you just look at the Seder just as a general thing, and you don't really key on the detailed aspects of it, you're kind of getting it. It's like going to the symphony but not understanding it. Yeah, I get it. Oh, we'll do the four cups of wine, we'll eat some matzah. Yeah, it's nice stuff to do, it's symbolic. It's our history. Great. Let's, you know, but let's kind of hurry up a little bit. All right, it's going to take you forever. So that's his point. Is that so? Why is he bringing up the Afikoman? So what's the language here? Ein maftirin achar Pesach Afikoman. So what's the last thing? How does he end the wise son? You tell him all the laws of Passover up to we do not taste anything after the Passover Afikoman. So he Rav Kook interprets this to say that sorry, I'm just going to try. don't think the best way to put it. That means to say that we want to leave the taste in our mouth. The idea is that the afikoman is supposed to be the last taste we have in our mouth. To, you know, we're supposed to leave the Seder with a taste of the Seder in our mouth. And the taste of the Seder is the taste of matzah, as pleasant as it is, right? So that's why the idea is the last thing we're supposed to eat in the night of the Seder, the last thing we're supposed to eat is the matzah, the afikoman. So that we leave the Seder with the Seder present, you know, quote unquote, present in our mouth. So so that connects back that if you're asking these questions and you're thinking of it in this way, and you get a deep appreciation for something, then you leave with that taste in your mouth. Because now you have a taste for it, you have an appreciation for it. That's how we interpret it. Okay, any questions on this? We're moving on to the next one. Questions, comments? Okay, so that's piece number one. And that's, again, that's... So we're getting a sense of... He'll take something specific, something detailed, but he wants to get macro with it. Rav Kook wants to get big picture with things. That's kind of where his focus is going to go. Okay, number two. His approach to matzah. So this is something he talks about a lot, and that kind of permeates a lot of his discussion on... Certainly on matzah, but on the Seder as well. So... His basic question is this. His basic question is, we know we have a concept to eat matzah. Leonard, I'm not losing you. I'm not going to lose you, Leonard.
No, I didn't.
Okay. You know, my teachers, you know, my 10th grade rabbi would have, you know, threw erasers at us when we fell asleep.
No, don't
so. Throw that was what he did.
Especially against a lawyer.
You have to watch him.
I'm protected here. We've got insurance. All right. okay, so his basic question is this. We understand the concept of making matzah, of eating matzah and Pesach. That makes sense, right? And, you know, we eat matzah as we're leaving Egypt, and, you know, there's a lot of different aspects of matzah. But his basic question is, why do we have to not eat chametz? Can we enjoy matzah and have chametz too, right? We don't have these, you know, limitations other times of the year. We have customs to eat certain things, customs to do certain things. Why does it have to go both ways? Why can't it just go in one direction? Why can't, if we ate matzah, and let's say fine, you know, we won't even eat bread at the meal. The next day we'll eat bread. We'll eat, you know, the Seder night we'll only have matzah. Even we'll go that far. But why do we have to go so far? Number one, that we can't eat chametz. Not only that time, but really the entire 8 days. Right? It seems unnecessary. It seems over the top.
So and, also you can say the same thing?
But
why only in the sukkah?
But you're not prevented from being in your house. There's certain things, you miss to do certain things in your sukkah. But you don't lock yourself out of your house either, you know. It's like, you don't go that far. You don't burn your house down, you know. So you get it. So you make sure they only sit in the sukkah. And the truth is, there's no mention of chametz being a problem. The chametz doesn't play a part in the story of Pesach, right? The fact that we made matzah, at least part of it was, you know, purely accidental. Right? Now, there's two aspects of matzah, you know, just to kind of give a little spiel on matzah, is, you know, matzah has many components to it. Yes, part of it, the matzah, is that we had to rush leaving Egypt because the Egyptians were kicking us out, so we had to hurry up. But there's another part to matzah, and that is, we were eating matzah before. We were eating matzah before that happened. Actually, if you look at the commandment of the Karban Pesach, the Passover sacrifice that they offered before the 10th plague, it says that they're supposed to eat the sacrifice with matzah. But the whole story of them leaving hadn't happened yet, so why are they eating matzah? So matzah represents two different things at once. Matzah represents freedom and slavery. It represents what they ate as slaves. Right? What did they eat as slaves? Right? They ate things like matzah. It stores well, it's quick to make. They weren't getting, you know, gorgeous loaves of bread, they were getting things like matzah. And that's why it's called Lechem Oni, it's called the poor man's bread, because it represents slavery. At the same time, it represents freedom, because that's what we ate as we were leaving. So same thing represents both slavery and freedom simultaneously. That's why it becomes such a big thing. I like the way I like to look at it is that matzah is two-dimensional, right? One side's the slavery side, one side's the freedom side. You can just keep flipping it. I don't know. That, in my head, that's how I look at it. No one else looks at it that way, just in my head. But I live in my head. Yeah.
I yes. like that. But if you go to Iranian store or any Asian store.
Ah, good question.
The bread, what they have, is that very
it's thicker.
Thin bread. Is that anything to do with matzah? Because
No. Well, look, the issue is this. I mean, the way you make matzah is you combine water with... From the moment the water hits the flour, it begins to rise. So you have 18 minutes to get it in the oven. Yeah, that's the time period to make sure it hasn't risen enough, 18 minutes. The truth is, when we make matzah, they put it in within like 10 minutes, mm-hmm. right? So it doesn't rise at all. If you make pizza bread, it's more like, you know... If they let it rise till 16, 17 minutes, it would look more like pizza bread. So the Sephardic matzahs look thicker because they let it go a little longer. Oh, we do 10 minutes this way. We don't get close to 18 minutes, you know, so we can't mess up. And, you know, it's kind of just become the culture of what matzah is, you know.
Is there a share how much water you have to use for the flour?
What do you mean?
Before it becomes chametz?
If you have a big thing of flour and a drop, I think any amount of water. Yeah, I think so. As a side note, if you haven't been to Lucky's on Sloat, they have a massive yes. Pesach section.
Yes.
Much bigger than they've ever had. It was amazing. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. They have hand matzah there.
How did you find yourself in there?
Someone told me about it. They said you gotta go see it. What?
All the way. I just went to
they have shmur matzah?
They have shmur. They have hand shmur matzah. They've got a mat. What? If you go to...
What did you say?
And the Slucky's on low. Lucky's on low. The hand matzah, you know, the...
Yeah,
they have those. What?
The big
yeah.
one.
Anyway, just go there. Go to the left. The entrance on the left-hand side, on the northern end of the store. Yeah. yeah? And you walk. It's yes. right there. This is huge. You saw it, right?
I live there.
You live right there. Isn't it?
In that's right.
No, he lives like a block from Lucky's. Yeah.
Block.
Yeah.
He's living in paradise.
Oh my goodness, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I couldn't believe how much stuff they had.
What else they have that was good?
They have everything. Everything. I've never seen.
They have everything.
It's yeah, the syrup. I mean, it was incredible.
And it's cheaper than Costco.
Really?
Yeah.
From Israel, or from
the same kind of matzah.
Yeah, they have all these kinds of matzah. It was incredible. I was like, I walked. I actually went to the manager and I thanked him. I went over and thanked him. No, it's important that they, you know, no, that's what they know that you
let
care.
Let them know that you that it
matters. Many shevits and aviv and a third one.
Yeah. No, it was. I was so impressed. They have all this kind of. It was very impressive. Anyway, it's mood right along. Okay, I did it to myself. So why do we have to not have chametz? That's his question. Okay. So this is his concept. So his concept is, matzah is food without any additives. Okay, it is the most basic form of food you could have. Right? There is no right when you make bread, right? What differentiates bread from matzah?
Yeast.
Right, it's yeast.
Until it rises.
And it's right.
Time.
Yeah, but usually, what is bread? Usually, there's eggs and there's this and there's salt and you know. Say bread is very rarely. Water mixed with flour, let it rise more than 18 minutes, then bake it. Right? No one makes bread that way. Right?
No, you let it rise overnight and then you bake it.
Okay, right. But I'm saying, usually there's something added on some level. Right. So, most people focus, when they focus on the distinction between chametz and matzah, they focus on the rising aspect of it. How much is it risen? Right? The amount of air. He focuses instead on the additives. He looks at matzah as bare bones food, right? Food with nothing added. Food that is as basic as it comes. Okay. So, in a sense, he looks at chametz as representing a person who has been influenced in so many different ways that they really lose their identity. They lose their essence. Okay, that we have our additives, right? Whatever we are at our essence, whatever we want to be, whatever we think our core values are, ultimately there's so many additives in us from all different aspects of our life that we become some sort of amalgamation of many different things that loses touch at times with our true essence, with our true self. And so he says the message of chametz versus matzah is going back to our true self, okay? And he, you know, when you look at slavery versus freedom. So what's the essence of slavery versus freedom? Okay. So you know, the way he puts it is, you can have slaves who are very free thinkers. You can have free people who are not free thinkers, right? Who have nothing to say, who have no thoughts, who have nothing, you know, nothing interesting. Slavery versus freedom is, as much as anything, a question of how true to yourself are you? How true to yourself are you? And the more you're able to be who you are without any outside pressure to be something else, that determines how free you are. The more able you are to be who you are on your terms without being forced to be something else, that determines how free you are. So the problem of slavery, as much as anything, is that the Jews were not able to be who they wanted to be. They just didn't have the choice. So they had a small amount of who they were, but the most of what they were was forced upon them due to outside influence and circumstance. So once they were free from Egypt, the biggest change that happened to them was that they now, for the first time in their lives, had a chance to choose who they wanted to be on their own, no outside influences. They could now make that choice.
What about the 613?
So we got good question. That's next.
A little step. Bit.
All no, right. Good question. Good question. So how does God imposing rules and regulations on that work? Good question. We'll get to that. Good
put
question.
Put a mountain over there. Then.
What?
Put a mountain.
So we'll get to that. We'll get to that. One thing. It's a good question. That'll be a whole other piece that can expect to this piece. It's a good question.
Made them an offer they couldn't refuse.
Okay, so we'll get to that. I'm not avoiding it. So he says that the fact that, you know, if you look at the story of the matzah seems to be a very trivial part of the story of Pesach, right? It seems that the import is greater than it should be. The fact that the bread didn't have time to rise is an accident of the story. Okay, you know, it's like, you know, you know, it's you know, there's an earthquake and I'm eating a hot dog, and that becomes, you know, the day the hot dog. You know, it's like, no, it's not the day, that's the day of the earthquake, right? This is the day they left Egypt, not the day that they had worse bread. You know, like, that's what this day is. You know, it's very Jewish, right? You know, the day is defined by what you ate that day, right? You know, the wedding is the wedding. It's not, you know, oh, they had sushi at the wedding. You know, like, it's not the day you had sushi. It's the day you went to the wedding, right? So why is matzah become, and the Torah even calls it Chag HaMatzot? It's the holiday of matzot. It's just an accident to the story. It's so trivial. Who cares, right? So part of it is what I said earlier, because matzah represents freedom and slavery. Yeah.
Bread is very elemental to many traditions and religions.
Agreed. I'm just saying, it doesn't have. This is called, and the Torah's description of Pesach is the holiday of matzah.
Right.
So, it just seems the import of that detail of the story becomes out of sync. Even if you want to make it part of the meal, even if you want it, fine. But it just comes way out of whack with what actually happened. So the way he wants to look at that is, he says, well, you know, the idea of the matzah is that it is represent. It's not about the matzah. The matzah is not about the matzah. The matzah is a representation of the people, right? Just as once they left Egypt, they were stripped of the outside influences that were being imposed on them. And now, for the first time, we're bare bones, right? You know, and, you know, when you're a child, you're always bothered by, you know, oh, I got to follow, you know, my parents' rules and regulations, and oh my God, it's not fair, and all these rules, and controlling me, and I can't, you know, if I was an adult, I could do whatever I wanted, right? That's how every teenager thinks. And then you become an adult, and then you realize how scary it is to do whatever you want, you know, and then deal the consequences of that. That's scary, right? So, and it's difficult, and sometimes that multiplicity of choice almost, you know, you can hide behind not making your own choices. You can avoid a lot by not having to make your own choices. When you have to make your own choices, suddenly there's no more excuses, right? Now suddenly it's up to me, and that's a scary place to be. So the Jews, for the first time, are now in that place. They're in that scary place, but free place, where they can choose now what they want to be. And so the matzah represents the Jewish people at that time, and is really supposed to be a lesson to us that Pesach is supposed to be about us stripping away our additives and stripping away the outside influences and recognizing what they are, and then ultimately coming back to our core, to who we are. It's about it's about making ourselves into matzah, the most basic food item, the most basic, you know, combination, and that's who we are.
Who we are as a people?
Who we are individually and as a people. But yeah, as individually too. Yeah, ultimately it's everyone's mitzvah to eat their own matzah. Yeah. So that's kind of what he does with chametz and matzah. So that's why we need chametz in there as well, because chametz represents slavery, he understands it. Chametz represents slavery, matzah represents freedom. You usually think it the opposite way, right? You know, but chametz represents slavery in that we are not free to be who we are because you've got the additives mixed in. Right? That's why he focuses on the additive side and not on the, you know, on the rising side, because he wants to kind of make that point that that's what separates slavery from freedom. So again, it's interesting because there's some Hasidic elements to that line of thought, right? Again, it's homiletic, but it's not Hasidic thought. And we'll see next week. It doesn't have the same flavor of Hasidic thought, but it's drash, it's homiletic. And so that's where he wants to go with it. So again, just contrasting, last week was very focused and very pointed and very detail-oriented. Here, he'll take a detail, but he, you know, that's only to bring out the big picture. But what he ultimately wants to do is create themes, right? That's what I'm saying. He's very thematic. He wants to create a theme that will help us explain, you know, a broad swath of what's going on here. Any question on this piece before we go on to the next one? Give me a second. Let me just look over the next one to make sure I get it right in my head. Okay. Give me 1 second here. Okay. So so the Avadim Hayinu. So after the four questions, this is what we say: Avadim Hayinu l'par b'Mitzrayim v'yotzienu Hashem Elokeinu misham b'yad chazaka uvizroa nituya. We were slaves to Paro in Egypt, and God our Lord took us out of there with a strong hand and with an outstretched arm. Okay? So what he wants to understand in these two terms, what is the strong hand of God and what is the outstretched arm of God? Right? Obviously these are not literal, these are anthropomorphic. You know. Does God have a weak hand? Right? He has trouble going left, so he's gotta
sure.
Right. What? I wasn't talking politically, Neil. Oh, God. Oh, my God. he gets one in every class. Somehow, I can try as hard as I can try so hard to not give him material. He finds it anyway. All right. So what does this mean? What is the outstretched hand, and what is the the strong hand? So this is how he understands it. The strong hand represents being forced. Okay. What was asked of us? What was asked of the Jewish people as they left Egypt was really unfair, right? It was really unfair. It's unfair to ask a people that have been slaves for, you know, 100 to 150 years, whatever it was exactly, to then turn around and within a matter of weeks be ready to accept the Torah. It's an unfair request, right? It's unrealistic. It's an unfair request. It's too much too soon, okay? Give him a few years at least. Give him something. Let him adjust. I mean, you talk about the amount of adjustment they had to make. And it's not like the whole process of even leaving Egypt was so long. 10 plagues happened within, you know, a year, year and a half from the moment they start. So that gave them some time to kind of wrap their heads around what was happening. But most changes in people, you know, in the society, it takes a generation or two usually. Right, I mean, again, look at the civil rights movement here, and the Civil War ends in the 1860s. Where is this country in 1950? Right, it's almost 100 years, and still, many parts of this society had not really, you know, I mean, no one in 1950, you know, who was a decision maker or was running society was alive in 1865. Everyone had been born and raised in a world without slavery. And yet, it's, you know, it, you know, Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream, is 100 years later. So, and it takes time for, you know, now what makes it more complicated in America is that, you know, it's the same group, the group of people that had owned the slaves were still living there and trying to reform society with the people that were, so that makes it more complicated. The Jews left, you know, if the Jews tried to become free within Egypt, it would have been a more complicated scenario. But be that as it may, still it takes time even for people to look at themselves differently. That doesn't happen overnight. And that can take...
Sometimes it's better to do it at once as a shock than wait until everybody cools down, everybody do this, do that, and I think it's create bigger problem. By giving them the Torah in so short of the time, it shocked them and had that goal to reach that, whatever the Torah said.
No, you're right. I agree. But at the same time, you know, we shouldn't be so shocked about the story, you know, the sin of the golden calf. It's not a shocking story.
Yeah.
Right? This is, you know, less than 3 months after they left Egypt.
In context,
I'm saying in the context of their lives, it's not a shocking story. It shouldn't be a shocking story. You know, they weren't ready. Well, of course they weren't ready. I mean, who would expect them to be ready? It was too much too soon. So
80% did not leave to begin with. So those who left were already.
Yeah, I mean, there's two midrashim about that. Right, two rashis about that in the plague of darkness, 80% don't leave. Not every midrash is exactly that number, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it seems that, you know, according to that midrash, only those who really wanted to leave left.
Right? So they were already motivated.
Right. No, you're right. Saying to some extent they were ready to leave on whatever level. But you're right. So when it says that we left Egypt, God our Lord took us out of there with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. So it's referring to Hashem doing two things at once. In one sense, there's a hand of God that is the strong hand, that is forcing us into situations that we're not ready for, that is pushing us, right? That's the part of God that's pushing us. It's pushing them in this situation. But at the same time, even if we're not necessarily ready for it. So the extreme is the Jewish people there, but with us, it's God pushing us too when we don't think we're ready for something, when we think we can handle something, we feel like, you know what, this is as far as I can go, this is as much as I can do, and we're convinced of it. So there's times when we get pushed or push ourselves, right? And that's the strong hand of God. It's, you know, it's getting pushed into the pool, right? And let's see if you can swim now. I can't swim. Well, I'll push you in the pool. Let's see, if, you know, now let's see if you can do it. On our own, we wouldn't jump in. At the same time, there's the outstretched arm. So the Hebrew for outstretched arm is uvizroa netuya. So zroa is arm. So he makes this connection between another word in Hebrew, the word zera. What does the word zera mean? Is seed. Okay? So the word for arm is the same word for seed. I mean, it's not, you know, same root. In Hebrew, we work off of roots, right? And root words that we connect them, we'll often make connection. So he says that the connection here is that a seed implies allowing something to grow, giving it time to grow. It's not ready yet. It's not ready to be something yet. So both were done simultaneously. In one sense, we're forced in something we're not ready for, but Hashem also had the outstretched arm to give us a little bit of rope, to give us a little bit of time, to kind of, you know, give us a chance to fail, which we do a lot of, you know, during time of the desert. And he says the matzah is representative of the strong hand, because the matzah is forced, it's rushed, it's not ready, right? That represents the Jewish people. They weren't ready. They weren't ready to go. They weren't ready for prime time. So that's the matzah. It's rushed. It's forced. It didn't come out yet. It's not ready. You're just forcing it on. Take your time. But we can't. We got to do it now. We got to do it now. Even if it's not ready. That's the matzah. The matzah is that side of the story. That side of us. And the other side is the patience that it takes. So that he says is the maror. That's a little hard. You know, I'll read to you what he writes here. The maror represents the outstretched arm. The maror reminds us of the bitterness of slavery. The very fact that we felt this bitterness is an indication that servitude contradicts our true essence. By virtue of our inner nature, we'll slowly but surely realize our true potential. So, you know, I still haven't fully wrapped my head around the idea. But the maror represents the transition we had to make from slave to free, because we still had that bitterness, we still had that part of slavery in us. So the night of the Seder, you know, we're not just remembering our, the bitter herbs don't just remind us of how hard life was. It's reminding us of the bitterness that remains even after the slavery is over. Right? And that's usually the worst part. You know, we have something in our life that is hard, something that doesn't go well. It's not the episode that's usually the worst part of it. It's the bitterness that remains afterward, right? And that can go on forever, right? That has no time limit. The episode ends, but the bitterness can go on forever. And so that's the maror at the Seder. It's not the message is that it was not that, oh well, we had the maror, then we were freed, now we're fine. We weren't fine, because it takes a long time for the bitterness of slavery to transition into a people that are ready to be free. And that's a process. So that's what he says. That is the outstretched arm. It's that patience to allow that process to take, to allow that bitterness to subside. Right? Okay. One more little piece here, and we'll finish up. Okay. Any questions, comments? It's nice stuff, right? Good stuff. Okay.
Well, are we free today from the bitterness, or are we still lingers?
Which bitterness?
The one you just talked about.
Well, again, you know, his message is we're doing two things simultaneously at the Seder. I mean, we're representing life, you know, representing the story and the life of the Jews after the Exodus, but we have to personalize it as well, right? There's a personal, and he'll bring things back to a very personal level. You know, a reflection, you know, growth and reflection. So he's saying, you know, in our life, we've got to find time to think about that as well. The bitternesses that remain from past things that really hold us back. And, you know.
But as a people?
As a people, but individually too. Again, he's constantly kind of giving us both at the same time. That's kind of one of the things he keeps doing. He wants to show us the macro and then also have some sort of personal side to it also. Okay. On the last piece here is something that this is what Malcolm was referring to earlier. So we talked about matzah representing freedom because we strip away everything, and then what do we do right away? We get a lot of laws. So he gets to this in the Hillel sandwich. Everyone loves the Hillel sandwich, right? I love the Hillel sandwich. I don't know. What is the Hillel sandwich? Who remembers? Yes.
Matzah, horseradish, haroset.
Everything.
That's it. Those three things. Those right.
Three things,
right. Okay. So what makes the Hillel sandwich unique? Why do we care about the Hillel? Like, you know, is it just like, you know, combination of all things you've been eating?
No, it's the good, the bad. It's the, like,
okay, so...
It's not all going to be good, it's not all going to be bad.
Okay, right. So the Hillel sandwich is combining the matzah and the maror. The haroset is just kind of mixed in. But the essence of it is to combine the matzah and the maror, right? So we're combining the freedom with the slavery. Okay? Now, why is this Hillel sandwich?
Like horseradish, it doesn't work. Give me more bitterness. Come on. pass it over here.
Exactly. You want to make sure you really taste both. Yeah.
You can hit mine.
Okay.
I'm with you. I'm with you.
Lettuce instead. This is good.
Good
idea.
Something
I don't like. Is what? No, I should put something I don't like instead of horseradish. Some kind of...
So what? Think about it for this year.
Cherry.
That would be interesting. That would be a new custom. Okay. So what makes Hillel? So why is it Hillel sandwich? Right? What happened before Hillel? No one ate this. Like what was Hillel's great invention? You know, it was like the guy who went to the peanut butter cup, right? You know, I got chocolate. I get it. You know, the first guy who puts it together, right? You know, those commercials. Oh my God, this is great, right? So no one thought of this. No one thought about combining them. The matzah's here and the maror's there, and you know, never the twain shall meet. So he's like what Hillel introduced was not just a sandwich; it was a concept, right? That he was trying to make this point, as Rebecca was saying, that we shouldn't look at slavery and freedom as being completely separate ideas, because at times freedom is slavery, like we talked about, right? When, you know, you could be free in theory, but if you are so heavily influenced by outside factors that you can't think for yourself and make your own decisions, then you lose all freedom, really. Then you're just becoming a slave to your society, a puppet to your society. So what is slavery that has freedom? So his example is this. You know, people will intentionally put themselves in crazy environments for a specific goal, right? So, you know, if someone wants to become a doctor, right? What does every doctor call residency, right? You know, residency is slavery, right? You know, medical school, residency, all this. Why do they do it? Because there's a goal in the end, right? There's a goal that they want to achieve. They willingly take it on. They willingly take on slavery, right? And we do this in all aspects. You know, what is being a parent, right? A parent is slavery. Right, I lost all my freedom. Right, you lose all your freedom. Right, I can't. I can't go out anymore.
What can kids do if you have kids?
Everything.
No.
You can't go. You can't go out of town. No.
Yeah, you can go everything with the kids. You can go everything. You that's excuse. I did everything with my kids.
No,
not during the first year.
What? When the baby, you are so excited, you don't want to move out.
I'll tell you what, Tommy. You can fly with Akiva to Rome this summer. Enjoy the flight. It'll be a lot of fun. You guys have a great time together.
Well, because you're restricting her movement.
Exactly. So, that's
the... No, I had the same problem with my kids. I went with Nadine when she was 3 years old to Budapest. Okay. And Adam got married. So
again, I'm not saying parenting is slavery, but it's limiting, right? It changes your life, right? Okay.
You
can't do whatever you want whenever you want to do it. Marriage is slavery in that sense. You can't do whatever you want whenever you want to do it, okay? Again. Okay, I better be careful here, right? My point being, we willingly take on aspects of slavery in our life. Why? Because we believe that there is a greater good and ultimately a greater joy that will come from it, right? That's why we do it. Right? If we thought this wouldn't go anywhere, if we thought that it wouldn't lead to a better life in the end, if we have any sense, we're not going to do it. Okay? So we willingly take on things that limit us greatly because we think, we're convinced, that ultimately it leads to more joy, to more freedom. Okay, that's the point. So, because again, freedom does not necessarily mean that you can do whatever you want whenever you want to do it. Right? That's not... Freedom means that you have the ability to be who you truly want to be, you know, without outside factors. But sometimes you know that to be who I really want to be, well, I want to be a spouse and I want to be a parent and I want to have someone in my life who helps me grow and become better. So sometimes freedom entails choosing limitations because it's aligning up well with what you want to be, so it's an extension of your freedom. So in that sense, the slavery or the limitation is an extension of your freedom because you're choosing to put yourself in that situation. So he says that what Hillel is saying with this sandwich is that we're combining the slavery with the freedom because that's what the Torah is. The Torah is willingly accepting limitation for the purpose of freedom. To truly attain, you know, a connection with God, to truly attain who we want to be, then we choose the Torah to go about to do that.
Guidance.
That's his point. Take it right.
You gotta sell them more, with more pravana.
What?
You gotta sell them more.
I gotta sell them more. Oh man, I didn't know.
Oh,
it's
not a cute rabbi.
Oh well, I don't view this as my, you know.
I'm
not in a, you know,
I'm not in a conversation.
I am. Well, I'm gonna cut out the parts about marriage, but that's about it. Yeah. So that's his idea. So his idea is that that matzah and maror brought together represent a combination of slavery and freedom. So a little something to think about. All right. So we got through four different pieces by Rav Kook, and you got a sense of it, right? You got a sense of him and the way he looks at it, the way he analyzes it. So it's a nice transition to Hasidic thought next week, where you know we're gonna get even more. So Hasidic thought is to take something, like I said, and not take it literally at all, and almost to move it into a world of the metaphysical, to move it into the world of theory in a very creative way. Now, as in Hasidic thought, while it's in essence it's very homiletic and allows for a lot of creativity, there's a few running themes that come through a lot of Hasidic thought, which we'll talk about. In some terms that you almost have to get a feel for to really... So we'll see, you know, we won't get to everything. But the Pesach Seder hits on some very common Hasidic themes. So we'll get to them and we'll get to point them out. And that'll be a good way to get a good like an intro to Hasidic thought because you'll through the Seder you'll get a lot of that. Okay, we'll pick up from here next week.